Hey, beautiful people, and welcome to the Tell Me a Story podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bell. If this is your first time on the show, this is the kind of podcast where I have different people coming on and they tell me their favorite story. And buckle up, because these stories range. From the relatable to the intense to the traumatic, there is something for everyone here. And I know you guys will love these stories as much as I enjoyed hearing them myself. Today I had Thera Pitts, one of the best human beings I know, and phenomenal YA writer, talking about her journey into doing stand-up comedy and how that led her into writing her first novel. Please, enjoy.
Yeah, I like your podcast. I am glad that you called me to be a part of it. And today I wanted to tell you the story of how I randomly decided to become a stand-up comedian when I was 25. I think it's a pretty good story. I hope your listeners enjoy. It has a lot to do with neurodivergence and feeling out of place and all of those things. So how it went was, when I was about 25, I was going to Cal State Dominguez Hills. I was taking English education, which is kind of hilarious when I think about it, because I've always been sort of bad at school, actually. Yeah, that was sort of one of my things. I have a lot of things, but that was one of my things in particular, like being the smart girl who is just inexplicably bad at school. So I've never had like an easy time paying attention in class or organizing my thoughts, I guess, in ways that are sort of conducive to succeeding in those more structured environments. So my GPA had always just sort of hovered around a 2.6, 2.7, nothing terrible, but just nothing really good either. But, you know, I always sort of loved books and I always loved to write. So teaching English just sort of felt like a natural fit for me at the time. And I think at that, one of the things that we needed to take was British literature from like way back in the day. I forget the exact time period, but one of the books that we were reading at the time was Beowulf. And that was, And that was a story I'd read in high school, like a decade before. So I figured it would be fine to just use what I remembered from it in class discussion without rereading it. I was working like 6 days a week at a bakery, and I was always trying to cut corners where I could. So when she assigned the book, I was like, cool, I don't have to read this.
But oh, no.
Yeah, because as it turned out, I didn't actually remember nearly as much as I thought. And a lot of what I did remember sort of bled together with details from the movie version that came out a few years before.
Are you talking about that, the one with the animated movie?
Yeah, that one by Rob.
I know.
Okay, I wasn't that smart either. Okay, I'll just admit it. But it bled together with a lot of details from that movie version. And that was actually an extremely loose adaptation, which I now know. And you would think that I would have just gone into class that day and kept my mouth shut. But no, I just had to get my hands on those 5 participation points by doing class discussion. And I was, you know, I was actually doing pretty well at bullshitting until I referred to Beowulf as an anti-hero. And and the second my teacher sort of knitted her eyebrows and was like, what do you mean by that? I knew, well, I'm fucked, but I just sort of kept talking. And I don't know if you saw did you see the movie?
I did.
Yeah. And so there was that part where Beowulf like fucks Grendel's mom because she's CGI Angelina Jolie. And that's not a thing that happens in the epic poem at all. And when I started into that part, the guy in front of me just like whispered back, that was in the movie. That was the movie version. And so back then I definitely embarrassed a lot more easily than I do now, because I didn't know I was dealing with some pretty serious anxiety, like with some other issues that just sort of come with being neurodivergent. I also had this tic disorder that's triggered by stress and embarrassment that was a lot more drastic back then, something not unlike Tourette's. So it wasn't just a funny moment that happened. I wanted to crawl into a hole and stay there. So I didn't go back to that class the next couple of sessions. I would just sort of sit in my car in the parking lot. And during that time, I was listening to a lot of stand-up on YouTube. The one I think I was listening to the most was maybe Patton Oswalt. He, I think, was, yeah, he was my favorite back then. And it was just, I guess, this sort of self-soothing thing that I did, because comedians are always talking about embarrassing shit that they did. And usually it's a lot worse than fucking up in class discussion. So it just kind of made me feel better to listen to stuff like that. And I did actually end up going back to class the next week, but I was still just sort of fixated on stand-up. I was just always sort of thinking about it and just sort of imagining what my own routine would look like. And couple that with me just kind of being really lost because I'd missed two classes. I was just sort of in my own head that whole lecture, just thinking, I wish I were on a stage right now making people laugh, because that just sounded so much better than what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was just sitting there kind of lost, I decided I'm just going to write a 5-minute routine right now. So while my teacher was lecturing, I just started writing jokes. And, you know, some of them were good, some of them were corny, but just focusing on that instead of feeling like a dumbass for the next 45 minutes, it was just sort of how I handled being in that room. And it probably looked like I was taking notes, so I'm sure she thought nothing of it while I was just sitting there just writing jokes in my notebook instead of whatever was going on. I actually did somehow manage to pass that class, believe it or not. I passed with like a B+. Don't ask me how I did it, but it happened. But after that class that day, I'm not sure when it let out, but as soon as I was done, I just sat in my car and I started looking up comedy clubs in Hollywood, because I was ready to go just right then and there. I was going to find an open mic night and I'd memorize my set on the drive over there and I would just go do it. And I've always been sort of the kind of person to follow whims like that. Like if something just seems interesting to me and it seems like something I could like reasonably just learn to do, then I'll just go do it for a while. So I've been like a cake decorator. I've made costumes. I was a street canvasser. I was like an internet reporter, op-ed writer. I did craft services. So I've always just been sort of all over the map. So honestly, randomly deciding to be a stand-up comedian is actually very on brand for me. It didn't like come out of nowhere, even though it did come out of nowhere. And on the actual, and me actually being on stage that day, I was actually pretty good. Because my mid-20s, it was just when I started really growing into my sense of humor and using it more in my writing. And I'd also done a bit of public speaking in high school as well. So while I was aware that my stand-up goals had sort of come out of nowhere, I did manage to not bomb my first time. So that was really a confidence booster for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it became something I started to do regularly after school. I'd come up with bits and just sort of go, and sometimes I'd bomb and sometimes I wouldn't, but bombing on a comedy stage just, it felt a lot less like the end of the world than bombing in class, you know? Because, because everyone bombs at open mics. It's just, it's sort of a safe space to come and put your own foot in your mouth for 5 minutes straight and have it not really matter. So that was just a really freeing thing. And after the fact, I got to go hang out with comedians in North Hollywood, which actually felt super glamorous at the time. Because, yeah, it did. I know. Hanging out with stand-up comedians doesn't sound like a glamorous thing, but it did for me, because I still lived in the suburbs at that point, and I'd never really lived in the city for my entire adult life at that point. But I always had, I guess, a fascination with just being in the city, which I blame television for that, actually. Yeah, I was an awkward kid growing up. So I just lived vicariously through those sophisticated people in million-dollar apartments who never went to work. That's what I wanted to be. If that were actually a college major, like being a sophisticated adult in a million-dollar apartment that never goes to work, then that's what I would have majored in. But I majored in English education, so. So that was just sort of my impression of city life. But as you probably know, because you lived there, city life is actually a huge pain in the ass.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Horrible. Absolutely. Like, 1 year while I was doing this, I went to an open mic night on Halloween, and this comedian named Dean Del Rey invited me to a show at the Comedy Store right after. But since I wasn't yet aware that trying to drive anywhere on Halloween at night in Los Angeles, it wasn't something that could just be done without preparation, I ended up going to the Comedy Store, but I parked in a residential area, like maybe an entire mile away. And I was dressed up, I think, as Lana Kane from Archer this year. So I had to walk that far on these high boots and this little skirt and in order to get to the Comedy Store. And it was basically just him, too. It was just the one guy. I was under the impression that it was going to be a lot of people, but no. And even though I realized, I guess, that Los Angeles kind of sucks, I still just had kind of a great time at those open mic nights. Like, I met a lot of cool people, and they, like, just invite me out to different places. And it was just sort of, I guess, the first time I kind of felt like I belonged anywhere, you know, because it was also, I guess, what sort of made me realize, I guess, who I was as an adult. It was like my first step towards really learning that. And my first step towards really kind of learning, I guess, what I wanted to do with my life. And it didn't end up being stand up. Like, it's not something I do anymore, but I did keep at it for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. I would just go to the different clubs and do my sets. And it was a good time that sort of blossomed from just me being a spaz in English class. So I'm sure that's probably not like one of the most thrilling stories, but I feel like it's a really me kind of story.
I love that story. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm glad you like it.
I've always been very staunch on suggesting that people should attempt to do stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what you do. Now, granted, I'm not suggesting anyone do what I did and make it a calling and you dedicate your life to making it a career.
Mm-hmm.
But I always highly advise, because it's like, it's such a unique experience.
Yeah, it really is. And it's just kind of a form of therapy, you know? It's like a way to like talk about yourself and unpack all of your different shit in a way that is hopefully amusing to other people. So, and you know, above everything, I've just always wanted to be, I guess, accepted and liked. And that was a time where I really felt that on the heels of a time where I just felt like, I felt like sort of a disaster at that point. So I would say that doing this sort of really felt like it saved me at this point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, even though it's not something I ended up doing, it's just, it taught me so much about who I was and who I wanted to be. And I think the fact that I am more comfortable using humor in my writing and in just my interactions, I have that to thank a lot for that, just for like kind of bringing me out of my shell at a time when I really needed it.
Do you think that moment on stage kind of put you in that direction of being a novelist?
You know, I've always thought back and forth about being a novelist before then, but at that point, I would say that I had completely given up on that ambition. It wasn't something I was thinking about at all. But being up there and just kind of pouring my heart out on the stage, it just sort of reminded me that at the end of the day, I was someone who liked to tell stories and wanted to tell stories, and doing that in writing form as opposed to a form where I'm like in front of people and sort of interacting with people, that's, I think, more my speed. So I would say that it did sort of lead me back there to knowing that I just wanted to be a creative and someone who just made people laugh and made people resonate with me. So yeah, I could say that it was definitely one of the things that brought me back to the path of being a novelist.
I don't know of anyone who who's tried stand-up and said it was a horrible experience, and even when it is a horrible experience, everyone is a crash and burn dumpster fire. And it's like, I never want to do this again. Mm-hmm. I've never heard anyone regret the fact that they did it.
No, I absolutely don't regret it. I would actually like to do it again when going out to places with other people is a thing again. I would like to, even though it's not necessarily something I want to do for a career. And I would absolutely really love to write a story about comedians, maybe a novel, maybe something else. I think that would be really cool because I guess have that sort of bit of experience and just being around them and kind of knowing how they tick. So
we'll have a wider range of references.
Yeah.
A good amount of us, and I'm happy to help. But you know, that I've always enjoyed your writing. I've always enjoyed it. And you know, for my listeners, me and Thera really got to know each other because we were part of a writing group together.
I miss those days.
I miss it too. It was like, if anybody's a creative, I would say that this was the best method for at least for me, to be very much more proactive with my writing. Because it was like, there was pressure, but there was no pressure. It was just, we all came up, we would say to the group what we were planning on writing, what we had written thus far. And we would just ask, where do you want to be next week? I want to be here next week. Okay. Yeah. Next week, we're going to talk about you being there or why you're not there. And if you got stumped, there was brainstorms. And I really liked the critique part of it. Mm-hmm. And that one rule we had where you could not say anything. You know, you just have to take the critique. Mm-hmm. You can't give an excuse. You just have to listen to the critique because if you give critiques, it prevents someone from wanting to go further into their critique review. And I found that so helpful. You know, I was able to complete a lot of stuff. I wrote a lot of material when we were working together. I definitely suggest that to anybody who has projects.
You know? Yeah.
It's so great to have friends, especially if you have proactive friends. That's the best part about having a proactive circle, because you all kind of keep each other motivated.
I got so much of my novel done when I was a part of that group. Like, it really was indispensable to that whole experience. So definitely, if there could be another version of that sometime in the future, that would be something I'd be on board with, because I definitely want to write more books. So
But I've been wanting to start a new one up so many times, but it's just one of those, man, it was just perfect. We had all had it was perfect timing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was something we definitely all needed at that point.
I'm sorry, what, you were going to say something?
I think I was going to say something about the book, but then I lost it. So go ahead and say what you were going to say, and then maybe it'll come back.
I'm so sorry, because I want you to pull out your book.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'll definitely do that. But, well,
Now I don't remember.
Oh, no, I was actually going to say something about how bad I was at critiquing, which has absolutely nothing to do with anything.
You did get kind of quiet when it came to critiques.
I'm always afraid of hurting someone's feelings. I'm that kind of person. And it's not even that anything was done too much to hurt people's and it wasn't even that anything that I came across was bad, but because it was all good. It was just, I never really knew what to say. And that was probably my least favorite part, was having to critique other people. But like, That's on me. That wasn't on the group. It's fine.
I was always worried about whenever it was time for me to hear critiques. Mm-hmm. I was always worried when Bear or Kara or Steve are like too quick to mm-hmm. like, oh, I think like, damn, you had that fired up and ready, didn't you?
Right. And I guess I'm bad at also remembering details. So that was the thing. So whenever I read anything or listen to anything being read, I just have a kind of abstract reaction to it. So mm-hmm. that's another thing about being neurodivergent. It's you don't always think in the same way other people do. So
is it like just scattered or how would you describe it?
You know, if you read my writing, I think at one point Steve talked about how it was very pastel, so which means like lacking in certain details but having a lot of feeling. So that's sort of how I process information. If I'm watching a movie, I don't necessarily focus on things like, well, this shot was really good because it showed where he was at that point. I just think more about how that shot made me feel, you know? Mm-hmm. I guess that's always just... So that doesn't really... work so well when it comes to critiquing people, but I like to think it does work for my writing because mm-hmm. I could find interesting ways to describe things that can resonate to a certain type of person. So
I always thought that when I was reading your book that you were very good at painting the picture. I sometimes feel that, you know, because we're both book nerds.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite pieces of literature, they get so unnecessarily wordy.
Yeah, you know, and when it comes to painting a picture, while it is difficult for me to do that, it's not impossible. It was just something that I had to find my own way of doing. Yeah. You know, there's a line in my book where, as opposed to her saying, I made a sound that sounded like this, she said, I made a sound like being poked in the ribs. So that's sort of the kind of way I've found to describe things, I guess.
It works because I love different writers so much, but I'm trying to think of the... There was one writer, oh my God, it was, you know, the fantasy novel world. And I want to say, was it Brandon Sanderson?
I know you've talked about Brandon Sanderson before, so it might be him.
I could be wrong, because I've only read like four of his books. I'm so sorry if there's Brandon Sanderson fans on my listeners, and I'm supposed to be talking about a completely different author. But like both fantasy writers can do too much where they will spend, I call it the token effect. You will spend
page
of info just to talk about one arbitrary thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, guys, just get to the freaking story. I don't care how beautiful the sunset is. I mean, I love if you can paint a perfect sunset. That's great. But like some of the best descriptions are always quick. They're quick. They don't spend a terrible amount of time. They just need to get the reader to imagine the general scenario. Yeah. But when writers go sentence after sentence, paragraph after paragraph, describing the scenery, mm-hmm. I am like, oh, God.
Yeah, you can't do that, especially nowadays, because we live in such a... Because everyone, I feel, has such a short attention span, so you have to kind of capture them quickly, you know? So I guess in a way, that's what I try to do. I try to paint a picture, but do it economically. Mm. Yeah, that's a word I like to use for doing a lot with a little. Economical, sorry. So... Yeah, I finished the entire publishing process, and now it is available for sale, and it's doing pretty well so far, so I'm excited about that.
Yay.
Yeah, and I really hope people like the book.
Elevator pitch. Throw it at
him. Gotcha. So my book is called South. It's about a teenage girl who lives as a street performer with her father in Venice Beach. And once he dies, she has to go live with her mom, who is married to this big city Baptist minister. So her life goes from really freewheeling and bohemian to really structured and repressed overnight. So she starts sneaking out of the house to go practice her secular music that she's no longer allowed to play. And she goes to the empty church to do this. She gets in with the key that she basically stole from her stepfather. And one night while she's sneaking out, she runs into this kid named Sam Cosme, who is also a musician and a member of the church's drug and alcohol recovery group. And after that, they sort of form this bond and decide to start a rock band in secret together. And it sort of goes from there. So it's basically a nice little forbidden romance story with this backdrop of the Black Baptist Church, which I think is a really interesting setting to mine a story from, just because there are so many different sorts of people that go there for a common purpose.
Mm. Yeah. Like, you don't really get to see a lot of story arcs where you are talking about that specific thing. Like Black church, Black Catholic, Black overly Christian, and like people, because when people think about Black church, you get the archetype of Baptist.
Yeah.
You know? And which is great. Yes. My family's from the South. Plenty of family members are part of the Baptist church. But when you get down to like West Coast, like strict Christian Black, that is a whole type of stuff.
Yeah, and I really thought it would be interesting to explore, especially the youth that would go there, because I would imagine a lot of them are feeling very conflicted about the kinds of things that they're hearing, and they don't know whether they should follow just for the sake of their parents or follow for the sake of themselves. So I thought that was an interesting thing to explore here. Because a lot of things that have to do with religion, specifically religion in the Black community, I have felt we're trying to proselytize in a way. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to tell any reader, well, this is how you should feel about God at the end of the day. I wanted to say, this is how these people feel, and this is how they deal with it, for better or for worse. Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed that book. I enjoyed being present as you were creating it. I enjoy being one of the first readers.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who doesn't normally read YA. That is not my, I like my sci-fi. I like my fantasy. I like, you know, I'm a Game of Thrones but so it wasn't even my kind of bag, but I understood, I related to the characters, you know, mostly, and that may be because I'm a Black guy from a religious family in Los Angeles, as a Black person from Los Angeles, from growing up in a very religious family, you did a lot of justice to that, that archetype and that culture.
Yeah, and I was really happy to do that, because I think a lot of people would find that sort of setting interesting, written in that context. And who was I going to say? And I think the reason why it maybe appealed to people who don't necessarily like YA in general is possibly because of the humor, because humor is something that everyone can kind of latch on to. Mm-hmm. So I just tried my best to imbue that part of me into it, even though it's definitely not the whole tone of the story. I feel like that is a highlight. So I like to think that's part of what people liked about it, but But yeah, I just really wanted to create a relatable story that people could get invested in and characters that they could root for. And even if they couldn't root for them, understand them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a really good experience writing that. And I definitely hope to write many more to come. I also sort of want to stretch my legs a little bit when it comes, spread my wings when it comes to genre, because right now I'm working on both a sci-fi story and a historical fiction story. We'll see which one I finish first.
Well, that should be fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
Historical fiction?
Yeah, I'm writing a historical fiction about this white passing actress in the 1920s who, no, I'm sorry, the 1940s, Jesus, who is on the brink of a breakdown and who bonds with this photographer. It's not entirely thought out where it's going to go, but I really wanted to write something about old Hollywood and lesbians, so I decided to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the other one is a sci-fi story about in the distant future when companion droids or robots that people buy to be their lovers basically revolt and end up sort of ending the world. So it's basically how the world ends because of too much horniness, I guess.
You're related, right? They're going
porn. No. It's not gonna be a pornographic type thing. It's from the point of view of one of the people who is one of the droids that was programmed to be a companion for humans, and he's kind of in hiding because they're against the law now, and basically any droid that was programmed to be a companion droid is no longer allowed to exist. So.
That's interesting. Well, write that one. Hell
yeah. I'm writing that one. Most of all, actually, you could read the first three chapters of it on Archive of Our Own. My name there is Black Lois Lane. Yeah. That's from my very scattered journalistic background is where I came up with that name. Yeah. So those are the two things I'm sort of working on right now. And as you know, you can purchase South at any point for anywhere books are sold, or also at my website, authortherapits.com.
All righty. Well, there you go, guys. Got to check out the book South. I guarantee you, you'll love it as much as I did. And that's Tell Me a Story.
All right.
And that's the show. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to giving you guys more stories, more guests. You guys keep on listening. Our numbers are growing every week, and it's thanks to you guys. So please continue to like, share, subscribe. If you want to support other ways, you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook. My handle is Bell Comedy. That's also my Cash App handle, $ Bell Comedy, one word, if you want to support other ways. We will have a Patreon up that'll be a little bit easier for you guys to directly donate. And thank you for listening to Tell Me a Story. Love y'all. Bye.